Support is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system. And by the team at Gelser Investment Management, focused on individuals and families, helping to build, manage, preserve, and transfer wealth for generations, commemorating 45 years in business. Gelser.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today, we present Henry Paulson, former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury.
Ever since the days of Alexander Hamilton, the office of Secretary of the Treasury has generally been recognized as one of the four most important positions in the President's cabinet. The Treasury Secretary is the principal advisor to the White House on all economic and fiscal matters. Most of the time, the Secretary works without much fanfare, but occasionally there are exceptional challenges that require a much higher profile. Such was the case in 2008 when our Speaker, Henry Paulson, known to his friends as Hank, was nearing the end of his appointment as our 74th Secretary of the Treasury. What occurred that year reads like a suspense thriller. And in fact, you can read about it in Secretary Paulson's book, On the Brink, Inside the Race to Stop the Collapse of the Global Financial System. In the years leading up to 2008, a series of policy decisions in both the public and private sectors combined to threaten not just certain major companies, but indeed our entire economic structure. Huge companies, including Countrywide, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, AIG, and others, were in serious danger of failing in the absence of aggressive intervention from the United States government. Toxic assets on the books of these companies threatened to pull down the entire U.S. banking system and wipe out the savings of Americans in all walks of life. This, in turn, seriously endangered world markets already suffering from problems in Europe. Our Speaker, working closely with the U.S. Federal Reserve and the FDIC, managed to put in place an unprecedented approach to the crisis, without which our financial system surely would have failed, and along with it, the world economy. In short, we owe this man a tremendous debt of gratitude. Prior to becoming Treasury Secretary, Mr. Paulson had been CEO of Goldman Sachs for 7 years. After leaving office, he spent a year as a distinguished visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins University. In June of 2011, he formed the Paulson Institute at the University of Chicago, which focuses on global issues with special emphasis on the relationship of the United States and China. He also is a senior fellow at the school's Harris School of Public Policy. He has the distinction of having been the subject of multiple movies, including having been portrayed by William Hurt in the 2011 HBO film Too Big to Fail, and by James Cromwell in the 2009 BBC film The Last Days of Lehman Brothers. He is also the subject of a recent Bloomberg documentary on the crisis. Well, we don't need any of these movies today because we have the central figure as our live guest, but we'll set the stage for his address with a clip from the most recent documentary on the crisis entitled Hank, 5 Years on the Brink. Sorry, From the Brink.
By anyone's measure, we are living in extraordinary times.
Prices are at an all-time high.
My goal has not been to go to Washington.
I'm pleased to announce that I will nominate Henry Paulson to be the Secretary of the Treasury.
I didn't really know President Bush. I thought there was a high likelihood there'd be a financial crisis when he was president.
20,000 jobs lost.
Third quarter losses of nearly 4 million.
The latest financial giant in distress.
We are watching this market
at lowest level in 15 years.
None of us understood the extent of what we're dealing with. Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers. Holy moly, how could this be happening?
Economists believe we are now in a recession.
I saw this moving from Wall Street to Main Street.
Every day, the American people get angrier.
Losing farms and homes.
Breaking me for real.
We needed to do something dramatic.
We cannot simply assist Wall Street.
We wanted $750 billion from Congress.
Hank was led to do things that were offensive to him.
Too big to fail is definitely not acceptable.
Congress has to act. We're out of options.
New York City fat cats expect Joe Sixpack to pay for all this nonsense.
The public wanted to hear those that made the mistakes are going to be held accountable.
And next month, they're going to come back and ask for more.
What we did was not for these banks. It was to save Main Street from a catastrophe. It's important that there be a historical record so we don't replay this movie all over again. Thank you very much, Deborah, and thank you all. It's terrific for me to be back in Indianapolis again. Great companies in Indianapolis and Indiana, and I like everything about this city except what the Pacers are doing to the Bulls. You know, that's not pleasant. I would also say that that I am a big admirer of Deborah's brother, Rich, Mitch, and that of everything he did in government, everything he did here, and with the Paulson Institute right now, where we're focused on, it's a think and do tank, and it's focused on relations with China. And sustainable economic development. So we do a lot in China, but we're also focused on promoting foreign investment, particularly Chinese investment, in the U.S., where it creates jobs and is good for both countries. And that's one area where we I've talked a lot with Mitch because no one's done a better job than Indiana in that area, and it's really pretty impressive. I should also say a word about my friend Al Hubbard, who was my close colleague for a year and a half in Washington. You know, he showed me the ropes. We were sharing some stories about some of the mistakes he kept me from making early on. It was a very special partnership, and he's the one. If I don't do a good job here today, you can blame him, because he's the one that signed me up a year ago. And now in terms of the Bloomberg documentary, I'm glad it was very brief, because when I see it, it does two things to me. First of all, it's an unpleasant topic. I live it again. And second of all, seeing yourself on screen, if you've ever done that, it's not the most pleasant experience, listening to my hoarse voice and watching myself. But I would say if it won't be coming to a theater in Indianapolis, but it is on Netflix and on iTunes. Now, I thought what I would do today is just make some relatively brief remarks. I use the word relatively because brevity is not one of my virtues, but I'm going to try to be brief, so we'll have plenty of time for our questions. And when we get to the questions, there's nothing you can ask that will offend me. I've heard it all. I've been grilled by Congress, and I welcome any question. But to start with, where the movie left off, that in 2008, we were hit with a massive credit crisis and this big bubble, which had been building for a long time, burst. And we really were on the brink. And so I think it's interesting to take a step back and look where we are, where our economy is 5 years later. To begin with, despite the volatility in the markets and what happened to the equity market yesterday, I would say that our capital markets are in much, much better shape. And I can tell you, we have
the most competitive, the most efficient, the most transparent capital markets of any country in the world. So there are, you know, the markets are better regulated, the banks are better capitalized today. It's not without problems, but I'll tell you, the markets are functioning as normal. And if you look at the economy overall, you know, we've been growing at roughly 2% since the third quarter of 2009. It looks like the last couple quarters like we're growing quicker. I expect us to do better in here. And let me say, it's not enough, but it's pretty remarkable given that we've done all this while we've gone through this massive deleveraging. And I'm very cognizant of the fact that too many Americans are unemployed, that wages have been stagnant, that we've got certain competitiveness issues. I think it's going to take a while, and it's going to be very difficult to get our growth to where we need it to be in order to employ the people we're going to need to employ and to get this, you know, get wages moving up. It's not easy. Part of the problems, I think, are related to what we've went through with the crisis. I think a lot of the problems are related to sort of some long-term secular issues, the impact of globalization, the impact of technology, declining competitiveness. But stepping back, we're in remarkable shape, and here I want to make my first major point, which is part of it is due to what took place in Washington, but I was in Washington yesterday, and let me say, they may think they're the center of the universe, but they're not, you know. And a lot of it is what takes place throughout America. And as I met certain business people, before coming in here for lunch, I just need to tell you that I think that I've worked with corporations for many years. I started in 1974, and I work with them today, even though I do not-for-profit activities. I partner often with companies. And I would say our companies are the best in the world. They're the best managed in the world. And I know there's some retired CEOs here today, as I am a retired CEO, but I tell you, CEOs are better than they ever were. The job is more difficult than it's ever been. It's more competitive than it's ever been, but our companies are the best managed in the world. And I got to tell you, you go to the Midwest, I think you've got the best companies in the U.S. And so that's a core strength. And the other thing you've got to say, when you look at government, there's a lot of criticism aimed at Washington, but when you look at what's happened in states like Indiana, you know, with Mitch Daniels and with Governor Pence, you look at what's happened in Ohio with Governor Kasich. You look at Walker in Wisconsin. It's pretty darn remarkable. Now, I come from a state, Illinois, that can't say that, but I you see the difference in leadership, right? Pence or Quinn, right? Take your choice. But I think the results speak for themselves, and I'm not partisan at all by nature. So now let me get to just a couple of questions that I get asked all the time before we go into a Q&A session. I get asked all the time, Hank, are we going to have another financial crisis? And that's an easy answer, because the answer is, of course we will. Yes, we will. From the beginning of time, as long as there have been markets, we've had financial crises. Most of them are manageable without spilling over into the greater economy. What we really want to do is avoid something like the Great Depression or this massive problem we dealt with in 2008. And so the next question is, what do you need to do to avoid something like we went through in 2008? And again, I just make a couple simple points. First of all, of course, we have to clean up our messes, learn from our mistakes. And there's been a lot of progress made. We still have a few messes to clean up, but we're in much better shape. Secondly, you need regulators, policymakers need the tools, the authorities to deal with the crisis. We had a really outmoded regulatory system. We didn't have the authorities we needed to deal with failing non-banks. Today, there's a lot of criticism about Dodd-Frank. There's a lot that isn't perfect about it, but I do think Dodd-Frank gives us the powers we need so that a failing bank won't threaten to take down the economy, and yet you don't have to prop it up in its current form. You have the orderly liquidation authorities. There's a lot of tools that are available that weren't available when I was there. And then thirdly and importantly, we just can't let these excesses build up for a long time and create these massive bubbles. And when you say, where do these come from? They almost always come from, I would say always, at the root are flawed government policies. Flawed government policies. So what should we be doing to prevent these excesses from building up? And I just want to deal with just very basic economics and ask ourselves, answer that question, what policies are going to be the best policies to give us sustainable economic growth, to increase competitiveness? And if we do that, then we'll have the best policies to give us generational fairness, to give us a strong national security, because I'll tell you, as important as a military is, no country remains a global power unless they have a strong economy. It's underpinned by a strong economy. So generational fairness, national security, global leadership. So what policies give us those things? What policies are going to let us say to our children and our grandchildren, you will have the same opportunity we have. You won't have a declining living standard. That Medicare and Medicaid will be able to make good on their promises to you. So as I look at it and look at the things we need, you need two things. We need to get our long-term fiscal house in order, but we need growth. You got to balance the two. So we can't either raise taxes so much or do so much cutting in the short term, we ruin our fledgling recovery. So as I look at the things that the federal government can do, they're structural issues. They're immigration reform, right? We all know what they are. Tax reform. We have a tax system which is a discredit. It's something that, you know, Al and I talked about a lot when we were there. We need entitlement reform. And, of course, those things take bipartisan compromise, working together. And now, the lessons I learned from Washington, I don't say that it was that the problems and the divisiveness aren't greater today, and there are real challenges, but when I started working in Washington, President Bush had a very low approval rating. There was a poisonous atmosphere. I had a really strong leader as a boss, and he wanted and encouraged bipartisanship, and so it encouraged me to work with Democrats as well as Republicans. And fortunately, you know, I had a year before the crisis hit to get to know people, to work, and you need to have some successes, some small successes, opportunities to work together. And I had opportunities, and I learned the skills that every one of you have if you're in the private sector, which is you've got to be willing to compromise. You've got to be willing to listen to the other person. You can't say, I'm only going to do it my way. And so we are, you know, we were able to get some things done in the trade area. We were going to be able to work on some things, build a level of trust. And then so the thing I think I'm most proud of is that twice Congress worked, working with Democrats and Republicans, twice before we had disaster, before we had catastrophe, Congress, you know, Democrats and Republicans came together through two very difficult votes, first with Fannie and Freddie, then with the TARP. And to me, I take heart in that. When people say to me, well, it's so divisive, it's the most divisive it's ever been in history in Washington, I say, why don't you go read some history books? You know, why don't you read some history books? Let me tell you, I started in the White House in April of 72, 6 weeks before the Watergate break-in for Richard Nixon. Talk about divisiveness and poisonous atmosphere. Or if you talk about economic problems, I went into the business, I'll date myself, I started working at Goldman Sachs in 1974. Remember what it was like when, you know, there were lines at the gas pumps and interest rates were in the high teens and inflation was double digit and, you know, and so on. So, again, as someone who has traveled a lot and has spent a lot of times outside of this country, I would never bet against the United States of America. Never, ever, ever. There are other countries. We have a flawed political system, no doubt about it, but it's better than any other system I know. And one of the reasons why I would never bet against our country is because of what you see going on in Indiana, what's going on in Ohio, what's going on in Wisconsin, what's going on in a lot of other places, and what's going on in corporate America. Because I tell you, businesses are performing much better than our national government. And again, I'm just going to say that I'm not – And there's no one in our federal government that's going there trying to do a bad job. These are difficult jobs, and they're working hard. But again, if I leave you with any note, I'm encouraged about the future. I'm encouraged about what's happening, and I just don't think we should be too discouraged. I think we should be take some comfort in where we are today, and keep working. So. With that, I'm pleased to take as many questions as you want to throw at me.
Well, in that case, let me remind everyone to use the white cards on your table if you have a question for Secretary Paulson, or tweet us at @economicclubin. And he has generously given us quite a bit of time for questions, so we encourage you to send some. Let me start with this. There seemed to be many thoughts on why we had the meltdown in 2008. Some say it was the Fed, some say, and the low interest rates. Others say it was a buildup over decades of too much debt. Others say greedy Wall Street. Some say Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. What's your assessment of what really caused this?
Well, Deborah, this was a massive credit bubble. First, if you look at even the 10 years before the crisis, the bubble years, 1997 to 2007. So even during the bubble years, we had Americans doubling what they borrowed. So borrowing much more than they could afford to try to maintain an unaffordable standard of living because median income was flat, okay? People have talked about income inequality. I use the word income disparity. And so I think we had declining competitiveness. I think that in the most fundamental sense, Americans, individuals were borrowing more than they could afford. Our government was borrowing more than it could afford. We had massive capital flows. Money pouring in from Asia and, you know, just raining down through Wall Street. And then you had a breakout of complexity. Complexity is not good anywhere because it works against transparency, and it's really bad in finance. So you had all these complex financial products. There were a lot of mistakes made by the big banks, but at the heart of it all was housing. Was housing, and if you look at the government policies, that we really overpromoted home ownership. That the reason I didn't, and the reason many people didn't see the extent of the housing crisis was that ever since World War II, residential home prices had essentially gone up. We hadn't had a single downturn, a nationwide downturn in residential home prices. So if I'm an investor and I own a diversified pool of mortgages, I'm not worried about not getting paid. My worry is I'll get paid too soon because interest rates will drop and they'll be prepaid. That's what the model showed. And the problem we had is you look at all of our policies, right? Interest rate deduction, FHA, and then, of course, the GSAs, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. As far as I'm concerned, they were ground zero. They were the vortex of the problem. And so I won't go on for a long time here other than to say that this is one area we haven't fixed. And today, now when Al and I were looking at it in 2006, we are horrified because Fannie and Freddie were insuring almost half of the residential mortgages. Today, the United States government, Fannie, Freddie, FHA, various programs, are almost 90%. So that means the government is setting the price in terms. And that's setting yourself up for another bubble. I'm not predicting it right away, but I do think we need to fix Fannie or Freddie. We need to deal with some of these problems in housing finance. Sorry for, you can see that's one of my hot buttons. Because I think one of the things we did, I think the thing that I was part of that was the most impactful thing we did was coming in, putting them into conservatorship. You know, they were nine times collectively bigger than Lehman. If they'd gone down or even started to really wobble, it would have been disastrous. They provided mortgage funding during the crisis. Just think how far housing prices would have gone if we hadn't done it. But no one at that time was arguing, oh, yeah, they're fine, we should leave them alone. We said it's a timeout, but we need to fix it. Everybody agreed we need to fix it. But now they're coining money, and they're throwing off profits that are helping us reduce the deficit. So now there's going to be a cost to doing something in Washington, which makes it even more difficult. Sorry.
Well, we just have a lot of questions for you. And a couple of people have essentially asked, what should happen with Fannie and Freddie today?
Okay. What should happen with Fannie and Freddie, in my mind, is the current Fannie or Freddie need to be phased out. They need to be shut down. You can't do it immediately. It has to be done over a period of time. And I'm someone that's very realistic and says we're always going to have some role for the government in housing finance. So I'm not someone who's arguing the government should do nothing. So you have to say, what should their successors look like? And to me, the successors should be a lot smaller. We should reduce the mission. And that means you could limit their insurance to either by the size of the mortgage, by the income level for qualified mortgages, for first-time home buyers, or all of them. And then very importantly, you need a structure where private market participants bear risk and that the guarantee is explicit and that it's we charge enough for that guarantee that there's plenty of room for the private market. So that's what you need, and I think the Corker-Warner bill would be a good step.
We also have a few questions on the subject of Lehman being allowed to fail, Bear Stearns not. What are your thoughts in retrospect about those particular decisions?
Right. Well, I think there's a very good and clear explanation in this documentary that Bloomberg just did. Let me give it to you very simply. Despite the fact that Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, and Hank Paulson, who were there, have repeatedly said there is not a single power we had that what would have worked, could have been legal, and would have saved them, most people don't believe us because we did so many other things, and it was, hey, it was the United States of America. I'll give you the quick summary. When Bear Stearns was failing, we learned a lot about what happens when there's a run on an investment bank, because the first response was the Fed making a loan through J.P. Morgan. It was very clear, it became clear in a day or so, that when a bank is, investment bank is unraveling and money is running, that a loan into a bank run on an investment bank won't be sufficient. So, and we looked, and there was no authority anywhere, no emergency authority for a non-bank to guarantee liabilities or inject capital. So we got lucky there because J.P. Morgan was a buyer. And so they took care of the capital. They guaranteed the trading book during the pendency of the shareholder vote. But the government was able to provide some assistance, but the government assistance, the Fed loan wouldn't have worked without a buyer. So we immediately figured it out. We went up, Ben Bernanke and I went and talked to Barney Frank and said, hey, we got a problem, you know, within weeks after that. And Barney, we need some additional authorities. And Barney said, I understand, but you'll never get them from Congress unless you go in, unless you say, hey, we'll have a disaster coming. If we don't get it, Lehman will fail and the system will go down. And of course, we couldn't say that or that would happen. So we worked right up. Fortunately, we were able to stabilize Fannie and Freddie before Lehman announced its earnings. We got Lehman to issue equity twice, do a number of things, but at the end of the day, there wasn't a buyer for Lehman, and there was not a single thing we could do. It could have been worse because we had one buyer, B of A. Now, B of A bought Merrill. We had essentially Lehman, AIG, and Merrill Lynch all going down at the same time. I think that if B of A had bought Lehman, Merrill would have gone down, it would have been worse. And so I think I'll just end at that and just simply say, today there are authorities, and the government has got emergency authorities when there's a failing any systemically important institution to inject capital or to guarantee liabilities. And so I think today there are tools that we would like to have had.
You've mentioned, I think you mentioned in your book and you may have mentioned in the documentary that it's been frustrating for you, or it was frustrating for you at the time, that it was hard to communicate what this meant to Main Street as opposed to Wall Street. And someone has asked that question. To be direct, as I've heard others ask, why should Hoosiers have bailed out Lower Manhattan?
Yep. Well, I got to tell you, that is the question I get more than any other question. It offends the Americans. You know, when I left and I looked at it and said, by gosh, we did all these things and we avoided disaster. The programs we put in place were successful. The money's come back. The capital we put out has come back with a profit. We avoided disaster. But when I left, there were polls that I looked at where it was clear to me that the TARP program was more unpopular than torture. And the same. And so at first I used to, when I saw that, it bothered me a lot. And I realized that it shouldn't bother me. American people don't like bailouts. None of us like bailouts. I was forced to do some very objectionable things that I didn't like at all, but they were better than the alternative. And at the end of the day, I think we got them right. But I think we never, when I went up to Congress with Ben Bernanke and said to the congressional leaders, hey, we got this big problem. The financial system is clogged. It's like the arteries being stopped up. The economy is going to turn way down no matter what we do in a couple of months. But if you don't give us these authorities, we're going to have disaster. And Barney Frank immediately saw, he said, well, this is going to be a hard vote because you can never prove a counterfactual. And it was late at night, and I said, Barney, what are you talking about? And he said, well, the American people is never going to give you credit for a disaster they didn't see. And so the thing that I was never able to do was to convince the American people what we did wasn't for the banks. It was for them. It was to prevent disaster. And at the end of the day, I think it's not all bad because we shouldn't like bailouts. And the thing that the American people really objected to is propping up failing institutions in their same form. And I think right now we got the tools, so that won't have to be done.
We have a question. To what extent did your previous tenure at Goldman Sachs predispose your proposed solutions for the bank bailout?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. I've had people say to me, the fact that you understood financial markets and you knew how bad it was, weren't we fortunate that you were there? And we had a situation where Ben Bernanke, who had studied the Great Depression and knew it from the academic side, Tim, who had been through crises before with Bob Rubin and the Treasury, we debated tactics, but we are totally agreed that the worst thing we could do was not act, and that we needed to do everything we could to open up the capital markets to prevent these systemically important institutions from failing. But to me, I think the proclivity that I have, which helped me the most, is I'm decisive by nature. And you need to make, when you're making decisions during a crisis and you've got this big, ugly problem, you're not going to have a perfect, elegant solution. It just doesn't exist. So you're always trading off doing something you don't like versus the alternative of doing nothing. And I'm decisive. And then the other thing is, as Al and I know, I make plenty of mistakes and I admit it. And so when the facts change and you think you've made a mistake, you need a change. And so the reason I'm able to say I made a lot of mistakes, but I think we got the big things right, is that when we made the mistakes, we corrected them on the playing field. With Fannie or Freddie, I said I didn't intend to use the bazooka. The situation changed. I used it. We put them into conservatorship. With a TARP, we didn't intend to put capital into banks. But as it was clear that we're dealing with such a massive problem, we then recapitalized the whole banking system. And I look at that and say, people still don't understand that. They say, why didn't you make the banks lend? Why weren't you tougher on compensation, et cetera, et cetera? Because they're thinking the way I was originally thinking about putting capital in a bank. It's what is traditionally done. You nationalize them when they fail. But what we did is something that hasn't been done elsewhere. We got out and recapitalized our whole banking system. That's why I think our country is in much better shape than Europe and why the stress test worked. But these things are not easy to explain to the public, and they were very unpopular.
You may have more or less answered this question, but someone says, if you could change one decision made during the crisis, what would it be and why?
Well, I would say the biggest mistakes we changed right then and there. Okay, as soon as we got when I went to George Bush, President Bush, and said, and boy, he was a great leader, and he didn't look at polls, did he, Al? He didn't talk about legacy. He did things that he knew were going to be unpopular. He was ready to step up, and I went to him and said, sir, I think we're wrong. I don't think this illiquid asset purchase is going to work. We have to put capital. He didn't hesitate a minute. He just simply said, you've got to do what you think is right to save our economy. So we made those. So in terms of all the things, there's a list of things that were done that I wish we hadn't done. You know, I think big banks were a problem. We made them bigger, okay? That was better than having them fail. It's hard to manage. I wish we'd been able to put Fannie and Freddie on a path to reform, okay, rather than having them be bigger today. I don't think there's any more we could have done, but I sure wish we'd done that. As Al knows, because we talked about it all the time, I wish we'd been able to design some program that helped Americans who were losing their homes avoid default. And so we did a lot of voluntary things. I wish we could have done more of that. But biggest, most of all, I wish I were a convincing orator and had been able to have the American people understand what we were doing and why we were doing it. I think I was very good in one-on-one. I was very good up at the Hill working with caucuses when it wasn't in a hearing and persuading people. But publicly, I didn't do it. And when I had to decide, when the system was on the brink, and I had to decide between telling many people what they wanted to hear, which is we're going to hold those bankers accountable, we're going to get them, you know, we're going to punish the banks, and I had to decide between that and stability. It's pretty hard to punish and save something at the same time, and I was so afraid of the system collapsing, I decided on stability.
If the largest banks are too big to fail, should they be broken up?
The too big to fail is really something that is unacceptable, and it just shouldn't be acceptable to us. And I think size isn't the only issue. You know, it's really complexity. It's very hard to just look at size and its interconnectedness and so on. So the way I look at this is what is being done right now, I think, is the right thing. So I think the first thing you do is you take away the advantages of size by having there be bigger capital requirements and bigger liquidity requirements. That's what Dodd-Frank calls for. That's what's going to be, the Fed has proposed to be done with Basel. You may have to do more, but that's very important, and that's the ultimate defense against failure, number one. Number two, regulators have real authority. If a bank screws up and shows they can't handle a line of business or they're making mistakes, they can force divestitures, they can put limits on size, et cetera. And then I think very, very importantly, that you have these these orderly liquidation authorities, resolution authorities, so you won't, because I think it's important, during a crisis, almost any bank of any size is too big to liquidate immediately. But that doesn't mean you need to prop them up in their current form. So again, I'm not saying that there's no problems with the big banks. Al knows that I talked frequently about its size can be an enemy of excellence. They're not easy to manage. But I think that's where all the focus has been. That's where all the press has been. And I think there are other issues that deserve more focus, like housing policy, like Fannie and Freddie, like the shadow markets. We still haven't fixed the money market funds. You know, there's more to be done in the repo market. These are things that people don't generally understand as much or as well. But again, my focus is on other things right now.
We just have a couple minutes, but we've had a lot of questions about China, and you are currently working with respect to China. You probably know as much as anyone in the country about China. Can you give us an idea of your thoughts about the Chinese economy, the future of that economy, the impact of human rights, the environment issues on that economy, and how it will affect us?
Yeah, so I'm going to...
In 2 minutes or less.
I will try very, very hard. This is torture for me. Torture. Asking something I'd like to talk on for half an hour and giving me 2 minutes.
Three
so let me say this. First of all, that the Chinese economy is the current model they have for growth, which is government-led heavy investment in exports and in infrastructure, that model is running out of steam. So they need to retool and rebalance their economy. And that's a lot easier said than done. So that's the challenge. The positive, from my standpoint, is they have very strong leadership. Xi Jinping, who's the new president, understands this. He's got a, you know, there's only seven members on the standing committee. They agree there needs to be reform. They've said that, you know, they've basically said what we were saying all along. When Al and I went to China, we said, you know, there's more risk in going too slow than in going too fast, that the government needs to play a smaller role, that the private sector needs to play a bigger role, that the private sector is the future of the country. They understand that. It's going to be hard to change. There's going to be real resistance to change. There's going to be ideological resistance to change. There's going to be vested interests resisting change. So what came out, when you look at China with a new leadership, they come out, the first plenum, you know, is when the party Congress elects the leaders. The second plenum is they do all the administrative changes and organize government. And the third plenum is when they come out with their State of the Union for their time in office. And they said all the right things. They gave themselves a lot of time to do it. They said it's going to be at least 7 years. The good news is they've set up a special leading committee to drive these reforms. The bad news is they have to set up this special leading committee because there's so much resistance. There's been a lot of focus on the fact that the new leader is clamping down on freedom of the press, he is strengthening the party discipline. There's a lot of Maoist rhetoric, but the party is the one strong institution you have in China. You don't really have the rule of law. They haven't dealt with all the institutions they need to govern. They need to modernize their system of government, which he's really working to do. So he's using the party to drive reform, and he's taking a calculated risk that this will work because he's going to do the things and deal with some of the issues that the people care about the most. The environment, which is just unsustainable at the current, you know, with all the pollution. People just are not going to put up with dirty air and dirty water. And dealing with corruption, which is a huge problem, very, very aggressively, and then the problem of land rights, mayors taking land from farmers and selling it to developers. So that is being done. We're very active. I'm there. I'm finishing up a book on China, which I'll get out this year. We are working on sustainable urbanization because I believe if you look at the next 25 years, you'd have to say what are going to be huge global events. One will be the next 300 million people going to the city in China. That's going to drive global economic outcomes, and it's going to drive environmental outcomes. And the another one will be these major Chinese companies seeking to become global companies. And so the way their governance, as they develop their best practices, that's going to be very, very important. And so those are huge issues. Now, in terms of the U.S., I would just simply say my view is very simple. People say, are they a friend or are they enemy? And the way I look at it is neither. We've got a lot of common interests with China, shared interests. And if you look at the problems around the world, you name me one problem major global problem, and I will tell you why it's going to be much easier to solve working with China. It's going to be very difficult to solve if we're working crossways with China. And so that's why engagement is so important. And I look at it and say, if our economy does well, it helps China. If China's Chinese economy does well, it's going to be better for us. And all those that are rooting for China not to do well, you know, I hope you don't get your wish, because if you do, you'll just see it's going to create a fair number of problems for us. So I'm sorry I went over, but you did it. I told you not to ask me about China if you wanted me to be brief. So, okay, you've been a great group. I thank you very much. Great to be here.
Mr. Secretary, I think you can tell from the reaction that you've been an extremely popular speaker, and but for our time constraints with the questions we had, I think we could have gone on another half hour or so. Thank you so much for being with us today. Today's presentation will be broadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM on Monday, March 3rd at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and is also available for download at WFYI.org. Please join us next month on Tuesday, March 11th, as we are joined by Jimmy Haslam, CEO of the Pilot Corporation and majority owner of the Cleveland Browns. Don't miss the opportunity to hear from the president and CEO of one of the nation's largest privately held companies. More information and tickets can be obtained at economicclubofindiana.com. Have a safe afternoon. We look forward to seeing you in March.
You've been listening to Henry Paulson, former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, part of the 2013-2014 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Next month at this time, join us for a speech from James Haslam, CEO, Pilot Corporation, and majority owner of the Cleveland Browns. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Radio in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Don Hibschweiler.
Support is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.